Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, April 8th, welcome, 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 friends, on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Almost all of us, Cherry, are touched by dementia at some point in our lives, whether it's us personally, someone in our family. And so today on the show, we just wanted to take a beat and talk about dementia and also talk about some of the breakthroughs and developments when it comes to diagnosis and treatment of dementia. And we're so lucky here in Philadelphia, I say this all the time, to have like world-class experts on all sorts of medical topics, including dementia. So we've got a couple in studio with us today for the main segment of the show. You can ask your questions about dementia. You can share your stories about caring for someone with dementia. And our question for you is this. Tell us how dementia has impacted your family. Are you doing anything to reduce your risk? The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. And like I said, also, if you just have questions about research, we've got folks here who can answer those today.
Yeah, we'll also talk about prevention because there's a lot people can do to sort of lower their risk factors. And we're learning more and more every single day. So we'd love to hear from you. Are you doing anything to reduce your risk? And if you have a family story you want to share, we'd love to hear it. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. We're getting a couple comments in already. So we have our trio.
Yeah. Of local news stories first. Yeah. Cherry, start us off.
Yeah, the two Bucks County teens arrested following a terrorist attack outside of New York mayor's mansion last month have been charged with multiple federal crimes, including a conspiracy to kill up to 60 people. Federal prosecutors released the 8-count indictment for 19-year-old Ibrahim Kayumi and 18-year-old Amir Balat. And in that indictment, authorities accused the men of providing material support to ISIS, a terrorist organization, and say that they were conspiring to use a weapon of mass destruction. Prosecutors say the two men drove to New York from Pennsylvania on the morning of the attack. They alleged that they both attempted to detonate two improvised explosive devices in a crowd near Gracie Mansion that contained shrapnel and TATP, which is a highly volatile explosive material that has been used in multiple terrorist attacks. And according to that indictment, Mr. Balat specifically predicted that that device would kill about 8 to 16 people or as many as 30 to 60 people if the area was crowded. And according to the New York Times, Jay Clayton, U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, said that the FBI found evidence of extensive planning by the men who post-arrest expressed fanatical devotion to ISIS.
Yeah, they also apparently, again, all this is according to the prosecution, according to the indictment, they had some dash cam footage of them talking about what they were going to do before they did it, which you would imagine would be key evidence in building a terror case against them. And so these are all the revelations now coming out as the federal government is beginning to prosecute its case. I'm sure more details will come out as this presumably goes to trial at some point. But yeah, we're just starting to learn more about sort of why the federal government believes these two men didn't just attempt to carry out a violent act, but attempted to carry out an act of terrorism, which, you know, that which matters, right? That distinction matters.
And I think what stood out to me is that they're so young, you know, and they're from our area. So, yeah there's that.
Story number two. Mm-hmm. How about a positive environmental story?
Oh, positive and environment?
Are we allowed to do that?
I think so. Yes, I would like.
Would
welcome
you give
that.
Me permission?
Permission granted, okay. Sir.
This one comes our way via WHYY's Zoe Reed, who, by the way, has been doggedly covering the impact of PFAS, also known as forever chemicals, for many years now. Hat tip to Zoe. So back in 2018, New Jersey became the first state to restrict PFAS levels in drinking water. And since then, concentrations of the chemicals have dropped 55%, according to a new Rutgers study. Now, Zoe and her reporting focused on the South Jersey town of Willingboro. They used to have PFAS levels well above state standards. Now there is practically none detected in the town's drinking water. Mind you, all this did come at a cost for Willingboro. They've already spent $10 million, and they have plans to spend $20 million more in the future to maintain the systems that operate the equipment that removes the contaminants. So it's not necessarily cheap, but we're finding out that it's very doable, it seems.
Yeah, and shout out to the Garden State for taking PFAS so seriously. If you recall, New Jersey secured landmark victories and PFAS forever chemical lawsuits reaching over $3 billion in total settlements with major chemical companies since 2019. And they said that they would use that money to fund the cleanups and natural resource restorations.
Yep.
And this seems like the blueprint for cleaning up our environment. And it's good to know that if you do the work, that it can actually be cleaned up. And one of the things that Zoe pointed out in her reporting is that in Paulsboro, New Jersey, which was part of one of the settlements, it's gotten its level of one of the forever chemicals down to an undetectable level.
Wow.
So this is how, you know, you always say, like, these things go into the water, they're everywhere, but there is a way to clean this up. It's expensive, but if you can extract the money from the bad actors, you know what, and you actually put it towards the cleanup, we can clean up our environment. We can do it, people.
We can do it. But you mentioned a really important thing is who pays.
Yeah,
who pays, right? Especially if there is a long-term cost, like a recurring cost.
Mm-hmm.
And settlement money runs out at some point. So that's just an important thing to flag. Who pays? Is it the companies? Is it the ratepayers? Is it a mix? I still think that's an open question in this whole area, in New Jersey and across the country.
Yeah, because this is New Jersey is not alone. These PFAS are... unfortunately, have been in a lot of places.
Well, they're called forever chemicals for
a reason.
Yeah. All right, story number three. Cherry, bring us home.
Well, today aside, okay, the weather in Philadelphia is getting better, and it's the perfect moment for Billy Penn to drop its guide to spring in Philly. And shout out to Violet Comer-Willen, who lays it all out in their guide. From outdoor rooftop bars to food and music festivals, big races, farmers markets, and a whole lot more. It's all in there. And I have to say, Avi, they have some cool rooftop bars. I got to try El Teco near 18th and Ludlow. Hope I said that right.
I don't know.
They have Mexican food, margaritas, tacos with amazing sky views. Got to do that. Also, got to mention that the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society's pop-up beer gardens are coming back.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, the one on South Street is opening up on April 13th. Love that. There's Penn Relays, Broad Street Run, the Germantown Jazz Festival, and a lot more to do. So I know you like the spring.
I love the spring. Who doesn't
love
the spring?
All of a sudden, Avi starts smiling and skipping around work. I'm joking.
So I might have
skipped a little bit.
I might have skipped.
So what are some of your favorite things to do in the spring?
Philly spring?
Yeah.
Philly spring. So I think you mentioned the rooftop bars, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's a little early for rooftop bars.
Yeah. A few weeks to go.
I need like an inside retreat option. So I like to go eat at a place where they got some outdoor patio, but you know, if it gets a little chilly, you know, you go back inside. So I would recommend American Sardine Bar in Point Breeze. That's a classic indoor outdoor. I just went to a place called Meeting House Pub in Kensington, which up by your way.
Yeah.
Awesome patio, but also a really cute indoor space. Memphis Tap Room used to be there, so that's a good one. I also think spring is especially good for people watching in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
It's like bears coming out of hibernation. You know,
everyone comes out.
And that people are seeing each other for the first time. So
and
just
they have a
just,
better attitude.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So just you park at a spot in your neighborhood where you know you're going to see people that you know. Maybe you haven't seen them all winter. I like to go to Triangle Tavern, which is at like a weird like five-way intersection in South Philadelphia. There's always people around on a nice day. I always see some people I know. And then I say people I don't know doing all sorts of fun stuff. So people watching, number two.
Love that.
And then number three, you know, it's flower season. So go check out a place in Philly where there's going to be flowers blooming. I've personally never done this, but I want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
There's a cemetery in West Philadelphia called the Woodlands.
Oh.
And back in the day, there was a style, I guess you would call it, of having graves that had planters in them, like embedded into them.
I've seen those before.
And over the years, a lot of those became derelict. But recently, there's this group of volunteers. I think they're called the Grave Gardeners,
who plant flowers in these old grave flower beds in the woodlands. And this is around the time of year where you can see those plots start to bloom again. And it's a really nice reminder, I think, of spring and life and the cycle of life and death. And so I haven't done that yet, but I would like to go check out some of the flower graves over at the Woodlands.
I love that. And it's garden season, so I can't wait.
Yeah, what are you planting this year?
I haven't decided, but I did go up to the roof and I'm like starting to prepare my pots. And I just got to figure out what I want to plant. Mm. But you got to do it between Easter and Mother's Day. So yeah. I have a few weekends, but yeah.
You don't have no idea what you're going to plant?
I mean, I'm going to do my three different types of tomatoes. Oh, yeah. My cucumbers. Stop. You will. And my cucumbers finally don't look like little aliens now. I've gotten better with those. So we going to have, you know, I'm going to try the carrots again.
I like the idea of cucumbers that look like aliens. That might be pretty good.
They were looking a little funny.
Anyways, we're coming up on our break. On the other side of this, we're going to bring in a couple of researchers to talk about the latest in dementia research. Don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Alzheimer's disease and other types of dementia impact millions of people in the United States. A recent study found that around 1 in 3 older Americans could develop the disease, and that number is expected to grow. In addition to the impact on patients, these neurological conditions take an enormous toll on families and loved ones. They also cost the country billions of dollars.
Recently, though, there's been some encouraging progress with new treatments and diagnostic tools that have a lot of people actually feeling more hopeful. So today, we're looking at the latest in dementia research and treatment. We'll also talk about the role environment versus genetics play in this disease, and also if there are ways to reduce your risk. So let me introduce our guest for the hour. Dr. Jason Karlowish is a professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and co-director of the Penn Memory Center. He also writes the column Neurotransmissions for Stat. Jason, thank you so much for being here on Studio 2.
That's great to be here, Avi and Cherry. Thanks for having us.
And let me also welcome Allison Lynn, director of social work at the Penn Memory Center. Allison, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
And we want to really hear from you, our listeners, this hour. Our questions of the day: we first want you to tell us how dementia has impacted your family. If you have a story to share, we'd love to hear it. Also, are you doing anything to reduce your risk? You can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on Facebook or YouTube, hello. You can leave your comments and questions as well in the chat.
Jason, I wanted to ask you first a pretty basic question. When people hear the term dementia, they might have some assumptions about what it means, but they might be like misassumptions. What is dementia, and are there common misconceptions about what dementia is?
Dementia describes disabling cognitive impairments. So an adult who achieved full development of cognition, got about in the world now, has developed problems with memory, concentration, and thinking, etc., and they're causing disabilities. By that, I mean difficulties doing life's daily activities, like managing the finances, preparing a meal, organizing medications. I think one of the most common misconceptions about dementia is a stereotype of what it is like to have it. Mm. And often people draw a picture of people with fairly profound disabilities, troubles with bathing, dressing, and grooming, which describes the later stages of dementia. The course of the, depending on the cause, can be as long as 10, 15 years. And in the beginning, if you met many of my patients, for example, who have dementia in the mild stage, and I'm hesitating, but they would seem quite fine, although they would tell you, if you had the politeness to ask them, that they are suffering with these cognitive experiences. Mm. So disabling cognitive impairments, that's the key bottom line issue about what it is like to have dementia and what dementia is.
Mm. Yeah, a follow-up question to you. How much of this is sort of genetic? We kind of teased that in the introduction. How much is it environment? And so, you know, because if you think about it, if no one in your family ever had it, are you likely to get it?
So the it is the cause. And in between that is, when I hear someone has dementia, the next question I have is, what disease or diseases is causing that dementia? Mm. The marquee disease that gets the top billing is, of course, Alzheimer's, but there are other diseases that are quite distinct that cause dementia: Lewy body disease, TDP-43 mm-hmm. disease, vascular. And therefore, once I know what the disease is, I can begin to reflect on what are the possible causes of that, genetics versus environment, et cetera. So, for example, in the case of Alzheimer's, there is a genetic association for late onset Alzheimer's. It explains some of the risk, but certainly not all of it. And in contrast, there's a host of lifestyle factors which also increase one's risk. And then there's a host of unknown things at this stage, things we don't know. Why did you develop Alzheimer's?
Mm. Yeah. Allison, I wanted to ask about like your initial advice for people when they get a diagnosis. Like, what are the questions they should start to ask themselves, their family members should start to ask, if they get this diagnosis of dementia? Because I know it must be difficult to deal with.
Yeah, I would say that people can take a beat and let this news sink in at first. I think people really want to hit the ground running right away, but this is not a rapidly progressive condition in most cases. And so they can sit, talk to their family, get support. But I would say, look at what a typical day looks like. Is it engaged? Are you active? And for the caregiver and the family, do you feel like you have support that can come over to the house and bolster you up? This is not a short-term disease. This is not a sprint. It's a marathon. Mm. And so you're going to need a lot of people around you during this caregiving experience.
And I wonder, like, how does it sort of unravel? Because I think, you know, there's probably a misconception that, you know, it sprung on you and all of a sudden you go from, you know, doing all the things that you're normally doing to being someone who can't do anything. But you mentioned, Jason, that there is this progression. So what are some of the early clues, because that would get you to even the point where you have to, like Alan has said, sort of take it all in?
Yeah, well, dementia is a bit like, I often think it's a bit like a fire in a room. I don't know if you have had this experience, but a fan member walks in the room and goes, "Oh my God, where did that smoke come from?" And you're like, "Oh, I didn't notice that."
Yeah.
It sort of creeps up like a bankruptcy slowly, but then all at once. Having said that, you know, just a few weeks ago, I interviewed Dan Gibbs, a physician living with Alzheimer's. I interviewed Dan Gibbs. He's a writer. He also wrote about his experience of having it. What am I getting at? If detected early enough, I can pick up dementia caused by a disease like Alzheimer's or Lewy body when someone's still quite able to put together what kind of day they want to live. And so a lot of our focus, working very closely with Allison, is what's a typical day? Is it safe, social, and engaged? And what are the disabilities we're facing here? Struggles with finances, difficulties using transportation, and how can we solve those particular disabilities that you're experiencing to address the potential harms that might occur if, for example, your finances get messed up?
And that's what you, Allison, sort of help people do.
That's where we work together. We are a team.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, we're a team, an organized machine. Yeah. No, I like to think of myself the analogy would be a surgeon and Allison's my anesthesiologist. Like, I wouldn't dare cut your body open without her. It's a bad analogy because I don't cut them open and Allison doesn't sedate them. But, you know, you can't do the one without the other. Without her kind of skills, you cannot provide the kind of care that patients and families need.
Well, some people ask me to sedate them, but I can't do that.
No, we don't do that.
We'll leave that for another section
of medicine.
Yeah,
that's a different
episode. So Dandelion Greens on YouTube has a question, as we're starting to just demystify first before we get into some of the advances. Is dementia inevitable in, say, a person in their 90s? Is it assumed, expected in aging or not?
No.
You say no. So explain that a little bit more, Jason.
Well, there's no question that chronologic age, particularly living past the age of 75, is a very strong risk factor for developing dementia. In fact, most of the lifetime risk of dementia kicks in at, say, age 75 and beyond. Having said that, it is not universal. But let me push back on, even if it was, suppose I said it was, so too is cataracts, almost universal. Yeah. So too for males, frankly, is some degree of prostatism. I mean, we could run a list of things that occur very commonly as we age, and yet we still take aggressive steps to address them. I might add also wrinkles. We do a lot about that.
No kidding.
So just because something's prevalent and common with aging should not lead us to the false ethic of, well, then we should just accept it and there's nothing you can do about it. That attitude is just that. It's an attitude. And it took much of the 20th century to overcome that attitude so that we could finally face the very important ethical problem, which is losing your autonomy, no matter how old you are, 70, 80, 90, is not a good thing. Mm-hmm. And we need to step in and figure out why, in the case of dementia, diagnose the disease, treat it, et cetera. And for those who are helping you live with this loss of autonomy, which is what dementia is, help them, namely help their family members.
Yeah, by the way, we'd love to hear from you this hour. Tell us how dementia has impacted your family. Are you doing anything to reduce your risk? We'd love to hear your story. Also, if you have questions, the number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And our streamers on YouTube and Facebook, keep your comments coming in the chat. I want to bring in a caller, encourage other people to get on the phone. Logan from Philadelphia is on the line. Logan, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, yeah. I was wondering if there's been any research in how long COVID might affect your risks for dementia.
Thank you, Logan.
Great topic. Very much an area of ongoing research. At this point, I leave it at that it's an area of quote, ongoing research. I will emphasize, by the way, research, namely through our National Institutes of Health. That's how we're going to understand the answer to your question. And I might want to let our listeners know that the latest budget coming out of the executive branch cuts the National Institute of Health by an enormous amount of money. So if you want to know the answer to that, make sure the NIH has the money to do that research.
Don from Phillipsburg asks, any supplements that might help reduce dementia risk, or is that all hokum besides maybe a daily multivitamin? So let's talk about prevention. Allison, what are some of the tools that we know work? And we're talking about reduction of risk here. We're not talking about cures, folks. What are the things that we know work? And are there things out there that you hear patients trying to use, families asking about, that you're like, oh boy, I there's just no evidence for this?
Absolutely. I think people are really vulnerable to these types of scams and these types of supplements that are being advertised because there's a feeling of desperation.
Yep.
There's no treatment. There's nothing else for me to get. And this seems like a savior. But there's really no one supplement that you can take that's going to reduce your risk of dementia. The best thing that you can do is to stay active, to eat a healthy whole foods diet, to get adequate sleep, and to stay social engaged within your community. And these are things that we say to do to prevent a whole host of diseases,
right,
but are obviously easier said than done.
Yeah, people say exercise all the time. Sunshine says alcohol-induced dementia is a big one. I guess slowing down on drinking could help.
Yeah.
Is something like that. Like, are there things you should be eliminating from the diet or getting rid of?
I was about ready to say cigarettes, but I don't think we eat them. But anyway, smoking.
from your habits.
Yeah, exactly. So the Lancet Commission, which is named after, put together by the Lancet, which is a prestigious medical journal located in the United Kingdom, identified what's called the Lancet 14, which are 14 modifiable risk factors that expand the life course from education in early life to hearing loss in late life, and then there's 12 more in between. I did my math. And they're all, the key thing about them is they're all modifiable. So among them are, for example, reducing low-density lipoprotein levels, addressing obesity, diabetes, loneliness, social isolation, cessation of tobacco. And a lot of it, as Allison pointed out, bundles with what's known as cardiovascular health.
Right.
In fact, a kind of a mantra that I think is a good t-shirt mantra is what's good for your heart is good for your brain.
Yeah.
And that's a start to then look at what are the heart healthy habits, because most of them are also brain healthy habits.
So you mentioned that list of 14. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of those, right, are like kind of, I don't want to say common sense, but like things that you just do to be healthy, and we know that these are healthy things. Some of them kind of surprised me, though.
Many of them have intersections with public policy, which is not so easy.
Exactly. Well, air pollution being one.
Yeah.
But also, I was surprised at hearing loss and vision loss being on that list as well, because we don't necessarily associate that with like cardiovascular health.
True, that is, and I will give you those are not cardiovascular health.
Yeah. But this leads to my question to you, Allison, of like, when you look at all these things, it almost feels like I got to do everything. I got to be healthy in every way to try to reduce my risk. It just feels so all-encompassing, maybe a little overwhelming. Mm-hmm. Is there a place you advise people or families to start? Because if I'm worried about air pollution and vision loss and depression and diabetes, I feel like I could get overwhelmed. How do I navigate that?
If I could put one thing at the top of my wish list, it would be to reduce social isolation. Mm-hmm. So many older adults live in a one-bedroom apartment alone. They don't see anyone all day. And being isolated like that is just not good for your cognition.
Yeah.
And so where I would start is to find a hobby and find a community. Again, easier said than done, but that's the kind of thing that you can try and start much earlier in your life and then sustain as you age.
Yeah.
And it's easier to do it that way than to say, okay, I'm 85 and I have to choose a hobby.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you might be a little nervous at 85. Yeah.
Yeah. Remember Garden of Eden. It's not good that man is alone, created Eve, et cetera. Yeah. One of the great punishments from biblical times on is banishment, et cetera. So, you know, I mean, we have known for a long time that isolation is not good, and it's a great punishment, hence solitary confinement.
Yeah. And Jason, you mentioned smoking, so I got to ask this question from Leonard, who wants to know if there's a correlation between marijuana consumption and risk for dementia, you know?
Well, with the loosening of, and or what, however you want to describe it, the laws around marijuana use, we'll figure that out in the coming decades. Right now, though, the answer is don't know.
We don't know. Yeah. Wow.
Can we talk? We have some callers waiting, but I want to talk real quick before we get to them about what we're starting to know or starting to learn that's new. When it comes to dementia risk, but also treatment.
Yeah.
Just real quick, and I'm sure we'll go deeper later in the hour, top line takeaways of like most exciting developments the last 5-10 years that are, for a researcher like you, like really, really exciting.
Yeah, the word revolution is often overused in science. You know, everyone's discovery is revolutionary, just like every child, everyone's child's an honor student and whatnot. Having said that, a revolution has happened, and the revolution is in diagnostics and therapeutics, and it's really spectacular. If I take the clock back, say, 4 years ago, I could tell someone that they had dementia, but my ability to say to them the disease or diseases that was causing it was always couched with probability, because it wasn't until you died and Eddie Lee, our neuropathologist, performed a brain autopsy that he could say, oh, these were the diseases. But of course, that was 10 years later when, you know, who knows when those diseases occurred over those 10 years. Bottom line is we now have the ability to use tests called biomarker tests that can tell a living individual who is at the Penn Memory Center what are the diseases that are causing their dementia.
Why is that so important?
Yeah, what does that information do for you?
Well, you know, I'd like to think that knowledge is power, and I listen to my patients, and this is what my patients tell me. Before you told me what the disease was with the result of that test, I was wondering, is this just all in my head?
Yeah.
Number one. And just the unknown aspect was kind of horrifying. I'm not saying that what you've told me is, quote, good news. This isn't unicorns and rainbows, but you've taken what was a mystery and horrifying and made it something I can understand. So what I like to think what the biomarker tests are doing is they're transforming the horror story into the comic tragedy that is life for all of us. And I think that helps people, it changes the illness experience. It doesn't make it go away, but it helps people make sense of it. And for some, if they have Alzheimer's disease and are at a certain stage, there are treatments that I can prescribe.
Yeah, because I was wondering if there are things that can sort of slow the progression down.
Right. There are, yeah. So, but never underestimate the value of knowledge. Humans don't like uncertainty and anxiety. We don't like it. And if I give you the cause of your disease, I can take away that uncertainty. And as I said, for some, though, I can prescribe treatments for Alzheimer's disease in the mild cognitive impairment or mild stage dementia stage. And these treatments have been shown with well-designed clinical trials, FDA review and approval, to slow the progression of Alzheimer's.
Yeah, let's bring Kathy, who's on line three, into the show. Kathy, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, my comment is that my father and both his brothers had Alzheimer's. I'm pretty sure a great aunt had it. And one of my cousins, who's a couple years younger than I am, has also been diagnosed. And I have another cousin who his family is concerned about. So all these people are pretty active culturally and, you know, outgoing and stuff. So I'm concerned about my prognosis because I don't know when my father started doing things that, you know, you kind of blow off, and until it became obvious that he got lost coming home from someplace. And so I'm concerned about my prognosis and the familial history aspects.
Yeah, I think what's behind your concern is, first of all, the sentiment of your concern is extremely common. I get about an email twice a week for just this kind of story. I think, first of all, the Alzheimer's Association has published what's known as the 10 warning signs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're things that you can observe in yourself or others can observe in you that are cognitive symptoms that need to be checked out. And if you're experiencing them, you should get those checked out.
And what are some examples?
Forgetting new information, repeating a story, difficulties remembering the day of the week, not the date. No one knows that anymore, but the day of the week. Mm. The fairly common sort of problems that suggest the early signs and symptoms of difficulties with memory, concentration, attention. I think it's also useful to have someone else who's in a position to, if you will, observe you. I realize that sounds a little creepy, but I think having someone who's available, reliable, and trustworthy to take part in your care is really very valuable. Now, for many, it's like, well, that's my spouse or my adult child. Well, we assume that, but I think it's important to have that candid conversation. What have you noticed, especially if you're feeling concerns?
Yeah, are there some things that are like normal? Like, for example, losing your keys, you know, repeatedly. Are there some things that are normal that may not necessarily be a sign of dementia and you might freak yourself out or, you know, and I'm wondering, Allison, you're like nodding your head. You're like, oh, my God, I have dementia. Or is it just maybe you were really busy or tired for an extended period of time? You know, can you help us try to differentiate between those two things?
Well, I was thinking as Jason was talking that the other side of this coin is that a lot of family caregivers are under such enormous stress and pressure that they start to do things like forget their keys or forget to pick up the dog food. And then they call us and email us and say, I think I have dementia too. Mm-hmm. And the key is, are these things happening more often than not? Are they one-offs? Can we explain them based on other factors in your life, your level of stress, other health concerns? Or is this becoming the norm in your life in a way that is interfering with your ability to like function independently day to day?
I want to read this comment from Glenn who says, my father died with dementia at age 69 after stopping work at 62. And that followed over 40 years of aluminum exposure working in a steel mill. Putting aside the exposure part, because we can get to that in a second, sort of environmental factors, but the stopping work, seems like Glenn was identifying that as a point where things started to go downhill. Allison, how do you advise people about whether they should work, whether they should stop work? That must be a very difficult decision. And I would imagine there's some benefits to still working and being in that environment, but then you also have to measure that against your ability to do the work. So how do you untangle all that?
Yeah, I mean, there's no right answer. It's a very personal decision, as it always is for people when they stop working. It's a huge life transition that we don't really recognize, as opposed to other life transitions, birth, marriage, even death. Retirement is an enormous shift in how someone's day is structured. And it depends on what type of job you're working in. So if your job is causing you a ton of stress and pressure, I'm just repeating myself now, that's probably not a great environment for you to be in. That's going to exacerbate any underlying symptoms that you might have. If your job brings you a lot of meaning and purpose and joy. And socialization, and you like being there, absolutely, why not? But there's so many factors that go into that decision.
Yeah. So interesting. Mary from East Mount Airy called us and said she took care of her mother who was suffering from dementia. It had an immense impact on her family financially and emotionally. For example, they had to pay $12,000 for dementia care. Her entire family is now very careful with diets and gets tested regularly. We're coming up on a break in about a minute. But, you know, you think about your parents or somebody you love get this diagnosis and you sort of snap into action and say, you know what, I'm going to come up with a plan. I'm going to do everything that I can. Is this something you see very often where, you know, getting to know people who may have this diagnosis sort of gets people to reduce their factors?
It does. I want to point out the majority, when you pointed out at the beginning of the episode, the tremendous triple-digit billion-dollar cost of dementia, most of that cost is that caller's story.
Yeah.
The money that that family spent, that's why dementia costs triple-digit billion to America. The American family is paying to care for patients with minimal to little support from our social insurance program.
It's not the cost is really not being defrayed. Is what you're saying.
That's correct. That's correct.
By our social,
and we'll talk about a little bit more about the cost and some of the methods of care and things like that on the other side. We also have a couple callers on the line. We'll get to you, but we have so many more questions, and we're going to hear from a caregiver as well. In just a moment, we'll be back with more Studio 2, and we'll also get the perspective of a local nurse practitioner who wrote a book about being a caregiver for her father through his Alzheimer's experience. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. This hour, we're talking about dementia, the latest research, how to reduce your risk, and how to manage a diagnosis. Our question for you, our listeners, is tell us about how dementia has impacted your family. Are you doing anything to reduce your risk? And if you have any questions for our experts, you can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on Facebook or YouTube, keep those comments and questions coming in the live chat.
Now we'd like to bring in someone with firsthand experience caregiving for a loved one. Melanie Cutillo is a local nurse practitioner. She was a caregiver for her father, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's when he was 65. After he passed away a few years ago, Melanie wrote a book to help others navigate this experience. It's called Navigating Alzheimer's, A Roadmap for Taking Charge. Melanie Cutillo, thank you so much for being with us on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And so, Melanie, we'd love to get your three biggest pieces of advice for someone who is helping someone they love navigate through a diagnosis like this.
Yeah, I mean, I would say one of my first pieces of advice is once you get the diagnosis to, you know, I took my mom straight to an elder lawyer just to make sure that finances were in check and everything was protected that they worked so hard for. Unfortunately, we had to, you know, take his name off of things and he couldn't be power of attorney. And so I think all of those things are so key when you first get diagnosed. When I pushed my mother to do it early on, she was like, this is too soon. And I said, it's not too soon. We need to do it now. So she was very grateful for that in the end. And I think another piece of advice, and I did not do this, so that statement, do as I say, not as I do. But I think if you can tackle the grief and the sense of loss that comes very early on, even while your individual is still alive, I think that's really going to help you in the long run. Find someone to talk to, find, you know, people, stay connected as much as you can. When somebody says, can I help you, say yes, I really do need help, and accept it. I didn't always accept the help, and nor did I even address my grief and loss, and so it did hit me very much after his death. So
yeah.
Another piece of advice.
And what's your third piece? Because I know, you know, it is tough losing your loved one. And so do you have a third piece of advice?
My third piece would be to try to find the humor and the laughter during the whole thing. I tried very much to do that. It's a very sad time, right? And there's lots of different things that are going on, and there's loss that's happening, and he forgot who I was, and, you know, all of those things. But I think between my mother and my sibling and I, we tried really hard to find the humor and the laughter in it and try to keep it as light as we possibly could. And I think that goes a long way.
Melanie, was there anything about this experience that really surprised you, that would have surprised Melanie before all of this?
I think I was surprised in general that he even got diagnosed. It wasn't something that I thought would be for him. He had other medical conditions that I thought it might be something else. So I think that surprised me. And I think also I will say the struggle that I had was because I am a healthcare provider. I struggled with trying to just be his daughter. And so there was a balance there that was very difficult for me, I think. I took charge on the medical side to help my family. That's what was needed. But in the end, I've kind of lost that daughtery piece that I needed to be there for that. So
real quick, we had a caller who called in earlier talking about the cost. Was that an issue you had to navigate? And just emotionally, how do you think about financial decisions when you're talking about the care of someone you love? It has to be so difficult and at times so painful. Like, how did you wind your way through all of that?
Yeah, very difficult. Thankfully, my parents were smart, and so financially, they did have money, right? But we did have to make a decision to put him in a memory care unit, which was very expensive and an out-of-pocket expense that it ended up not working out, and we took him out. But nonetheless, it was it was a huge decision to make, and to have to think about, okay, we can pay for it this month, and to really look at the, my mom really had to look at the finances to say, how's this going to be long term? How long is he going to be in there? And then when we took him out of there, we paid for care in the house for him just before he got onto hospice. But again, thankfully, they were smart financially and had money, but there's so many that do not have that. And so again, the reason why I tried to put some tips in the book, you know, to help people who don't have that financial stability.
Before we let you go, Melanie, I'm curious, you mentioned about trying to find the humor in the positive. Mm-hmm. Were there tender moments? Were there humorous moments through this whole thing that you still remember fondly, that you hold on to, like specific memories?
Oh, yes. I have several. I was with him a lot during the time that he was ill, and I was like his secondary caregiver along with my mother. And yes, I have many stories, you know, the day he thought he... The one day specifically when he was like, are you married? And I was like, yeah, I have been for, you know, at that time, maybe 18 years. And he's like, oh, great. I had no idea. And I was like, wait. I'm like, and guess what? You paid for it. And he's like, I did? I was like, you paid for that wedding. So we have great memories where we laughed. And, you know, and so, yes, I hold those near and dear to my heart.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. That's Melanie Cotillo, author of Navigating Alzheimer's, A Roadmap for Taking Charge. Thank you so much for your time on Studio 2, Melanie.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Yes. And now let me reintroduce our main guest this hour. We have Jason Karlowish, professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and co-director of the Penn Memory Center, and also Allison Lynn, director of social work at the Penn Memory Center. And just sort of to get your reaction, Allison, I mean, you know, she talked about, Melanie talked about finding the humor, finding some of the joy, but it is really hard as a person trying to navigate as you watch the person that you've known, maybe if it's a parent or if a husband you've known for many years, your entire life, sort of slowly slip away.
Absolutely. People who are caring for someone with dementia are experiencing a type of grief called ambiguous loss, which is the experience of grieving for someone that's still there and still present in body, but changed in mind and spirit. It's a very unnatural type of loss. There's no finality. We don't have ritual around that type of loss the way that we have ritual when someone dies, you know, funeral, religious reception, anything like that. And so it also goes unacknowledged largely by anyone who hasn't had this experience before, and that can add to the sense of grief and isolation and just deep sadness.
And quick follow-up, I wonder if there's a difference between if it's your partner that you lose versus a parent.
Absolutely. The relationship colors everything about the caregiving experience. So people don't walk into caregiving in a vacuum. They bring the entirety of their relationship history into that room. And so caring for a parent, you might have a role reversal where your parent doesn't want their adult child to tell them what to do. They don't want their adult child to be looking over their finances, for example. Whereas spousal caregivers have different challenges to overcome, like loss of intimacy, for example, loss of splitting of the household duties, or loss of a feeling of partnership.
Yeah. If your listeners want to learn more about ambiguous loss, there's an episode of the podcast Age of Aging called Ambiguous Loss that Allison is featured in that just came out a couple weeks ago.
All right.
Age
Good
of
resource.
Aging, Ambiguous Loss.
And podcast. you were talking, Allison, about that relationship between children and parents. And Stephanie wrote in saying, my father has not done any of the prevention things like staying social. He was eating blueberries and drinking coffee because he said those are the things that are supposed to help maintain cognition. While his cognition has declined, he has not seen a neurologist. He's been in denial for years, so he has refused to see one. He has not been diagnosed. It's exhausting. So even that dynamic can be there, even just trying to get to the starting line of a diagnosis.
It's very frustrating.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people who have dementia also do not have insight into their disease. So it could be that he's in denial, that he doesn't want to go to the doctor. It's also possible that he's experiencing something called a nosognosia, which prevents him from fully understanding the extent of his cognitive difficulties.
Right. And so he doesn't even see it.
Exactly. Yeah. So if I think I'm totally normal and Dr. Karlowish says, you totally messed up your credit card bill payment last month, I'm going to say, what are you talking about? Everything was fine.
Yeah.
In most cases, I find that those stories, though, are stories, and it's in some sense the hint I get from the one that you've just recounted, Avi, is they are aware, but they're very ashamed, embarrassed, and afraid. Mm-hmm. And I think that the steps is to try to get that out. Like, what is it that you're afraid of? What is it that you're worried about?
Well, there's a stigma, for sure.
Absolutely, there's a stigma. The stigma is a major barrier for people seeking help because of just that, the stigma. And to try to address that self-stigma that the individual's feeling.
Let's bring in a caller. We have a bunch of people on the line. Maybe we can get to a couple of them. We have Janet from Harleysville on the line. Janet, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Thank you. Yes, it's a wonderful program. I experienced dementia firsthand with my husband, who was diagnosed at age 69 and died at 79. And in the last 3 years, we did find placement in a wonderful place in a memory care unit. And here is my comment. Early on, we explored everything that we could to slow the progression, to keep him in good shape. But I have to tell you, in the last 4 to 3 years, we prayed for a fast ending. We weren't at the point anymore. We wanted to see a slowdown of the progression. I haven't heard anybody express that. It might sound terrible to you and your listeners, but it was a terrible thing to watch his decline, and myself and my children all felt we had done what we could. We just wanted this disease to be over.
Yeah.
I don't know what you have to comment on that. I'd be interested.
Thank you. That's Janet from Harleysville.
Thank you for sharing that, by the
that
way,
is,
Janet.
That is a... Thank you.
I'm not surprised. That's a Allison. Very common sentiment.
Yeah, you hear that.
It's a really common sentiment, and people feel a lot of shame around feeling that way because if they haven't been in a space with other people caring for someone with dementia before, they might not have heard anyone say that before.
Yeah.
So people often come into my office and say, I'm about to say something that makes me such a terrible person, and I'll have to say to them, this isn't even like the second or third time that I've heard that today. It's so common.
Yeah, we are in a great cultural conversation now, which we should be in, which is when does a mind die? And, you know, actually the definition of death right now is brain death. Having said that, we know when a body dies. But when does a mind die is an open question. And
it's a scientific and philosophical question. No easy answers there.
That's exactly right.
I want to say just a couple people with some positive notes. Laura wanted to shout out a program called in Westchester called Sunshine Cafe that provides socialization and programming for clients with dementia. Thank you, Laura. Robin says, a point that could get lost in the tragedy that some families feel upon diagnosis is how the loved one is reshaped, but the person can be different, but truly beautiful. My father with moderate vascular dementia is total sunshine. We absolutely love spending time with him. Thank you, Robin. Want to bring in now Dave from Highbridge on line two. Dave, we're getting close to the end here, but if you could keep it brief, what's your question or comment?
Sure. I wanted to see if folks could comment on something that I've read, that there's a connection between hearing loss and sort of acceleration of dementia. So I have a friend who he's diagnosed with aphasia right now, but beginning the dementia. And we've been trying to get his wife, who's his primary caregiver, to get him hearing aids.
Yeah.
And she just won't do it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I just wondered if you could comment on that issue. And then how do we convince her to do this? I mean, it would be easy to do, and it would,
Thank you, Dave. There is a link.
Ears are connected to the brain, and the brain needs all the sensory input it can get to function well. That's how our brains create a mind. We take in visual and auditory information, and we do things with it. And when the auditory information is impaired because it can't get in there, you can't hear it, it's going to impact cognition. It's going to harm cognition. So hearing aids may not be comfortable, or, you know, they're not work as effectively as they could, but any effort to try to augment the quality of hearing is going to improve the quality of someone's mind.
And getting to the point of convincing, I mean, this is never easy. I'm sure there's not one magic, you know, silver bullet here that's going to convince a person to take up any sort of intervention, but how do you go about having that conversation, Allison?
Well, I will say to the caller, you sound like a really concerned and loving person.
Yep.
I will also say that family caregivers, direct family caregivers, get a lot of unsolicited advice.
Yep.
So whether or not that advice would be helpful, I would think about, how are you talking to this woman about what you think should happen? What is your tone of voice? What is your body language? And get curious. Why hasn't she done this yet? What is the barrier? Does she feel like her husband is saying no and she's having a hard time convincing him? So to approach this from a place of curiosity rather than judgment will help ease some of the tension around this.
We are getting toward the end here. I want to look to the future, Jason. What's coming down the research pipeline? We've talked about the fact that there is this new class of drugs that seem to slow progression, at least in some patients. Is there anything on the horizon around diagnostics? Reversal? I mean, that's the big one, people.
We should anticipate, much like with cardiovascular disease, not too far away, an era when we diagnose and treat the diseases that cause dementia before you have dementia.
Oh, wow.
Much like you get diagnostics and treatments for cardiovascular disease, hypertension, et cetera, before you've had a heart attack or a stroke.
Almost like statin drugs, but for...
Correct. Wow. We should anticipate a future where someone like myself could be on a show like this saying, I have Alzheimer's disease because it was diagnosed before I was symptomatic and I'm on a treatment for it. Yeah. That'll be a very interesting future for us to live in, because we're talking about people who are still in the workplace, functioning, et cetera. Listeners know I do not have Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah.
But that is the future, diagnosis and treatment before metastatic cancer, if you will.
Yeah, and I wanted wedge something in, because we had this caller on for a long time, Rich, who asked about music as a cure. Are there, if in just 30 seconds, Allison, are there anything that folks can use to sort of bring back and have those lovely moments with their loved one?
Absolutely. Music is such a powerful tool in terms of easing agitation, spurring connection. And I would say start with finding songs or music that the person with dementia liked when they were younger, in their childhood, adolescence, early adulthood. Play those songs regularly, preventatively, but you can also use them in times of heightened anxiety, fear, general agitation. And it works better than any drug. Mm.
Wow. And we don't have time to get to Diane from New Hope, but I know she wanted to add that you know, there are ways to take dementia under control, I think, sort of preaching a message of action as possible here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And she's a caregiver for her husband. Thank you, Diane from New Hope. And thank you to all our callers and commenters this hour. And thank you to our guests, Jason Karlowish, professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, co-director of the Penn Memory Center. Jason, thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you, Ali.
And thank you, Allison Lynn, director of social work, also at the Penn Memory Center. Appreciate the time, Allison.
Thanks.
I learned a lot today.
So much.
Cool. And other people I appreciate. Our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, Hazel May Bryan, and welcome back to Paige Murray Bessler, a.k.a. Producer Paige. Al Banks and Mike Schiffler engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Audible Avi Wolfenaren. We'll talk to you tomorrow.